Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting, and I'm happy to have with me today our guest, Kathy Ruffino, Vice President of Train Me Today, which is a human resources consulting and training firm in Southern California. Welcome, Kathy, and thanks for being with me today.
Good morning, Dorothy, and thank you for having me back.
You know, I love having you on, Kathy. Let's get right into it because there's a lot going on in California right now, as well as on the national level, with, of course, a lot of new laws going into effect in 2024 and some that recently went into effect, et cetera. So there's a lot of different effective dates. Let's dive right into it and start with some January 1, 2024 new laws. First, let's start with the new paid sick leave law, SB 616. How does this extend the current sick leave?
So SB 616 is going to expand the sick leave requirement from our original 3 days and 24 hours to 5 days and 40 hours. And what that means for us is for those employers who are still doing the accrual method, it's probably going to be far more complicated, as if it wasn't complicated enough.
Right.
But now they have two requirements for accrual. If they're using the accrual method, they must still accrue 3 days or 24 hours of paid sick leave by the 120th day of employment. By the 200th day of employment, all 5 days and all 40 hours must be available to the employee for use. They can still do a cap, so they can still cap the accruals at 10 days, 80 hours. It used to be 6 days and 48 hours. And they can still limit the carryover of PSL annually to 5 days and 40 hours, which we all used to have 6 days and 48 hours. So everything being that, most attorneys are recommending just cut to the chase, separate vacation out of PTO, separate PSL out of PTO, keep them separate for the purpose of just simply making it easier and front load. Front loading is so much easier because it's just there. They're going to use it anyway. And I know that's why a lot of employers still want to do the accrual because they think the, you know, it will somehow mitigate people using it, but they're going to use it. So they just have to keep in mind this is kind of, you know, expanding it to the point of you might want to reconsider if you want to keep this in your PTO or separate it out. You still have to comply with all the other PSL requirements, including not asking employees to provide a notice for their reason of using sick. And if you are an employer in an area where there's a local ordinance, such as the Bay Area or LA and even San Diego, you need to comply with the most generous requirement, whether it's the PSL or the local ordinance, whichever one gives the employee more, that's the one you comply with.
Of course, because it's California.
Good times ahead, right?
Exactly. So there are two new cannabis laws. Let's start with the first one, Senate Bill 700. Can you tell us about this one?
So SB 700 is going to go into effect January 1st. And what it does is it makes it unlawful under the FEHA, Fair Employment and Housing Act, for an employer to discriminate against a job applicant based on any information regarding prior use of cannabis that they might learn from a criminal history, so a background. It does not preempt a state or federal law requiring applicants to be tested for controlled substances. So we can still do drug screenings. And if you're a federal or state agency, obviously you're going to be exempt from a lot of this, but there are requirements that we can still comply with for the benefit of us to know if we're, you know, what people are doing. It does not also preempt any employer from asking about the applicant's criminal history within the state law requirements. So if you do a background and there, you know, something pops up, we can still have that conversation. You just have to be careful as always.
So the first one was about criminal history. Let's talk about Assembly Bill 2188. That tackles off-the-job cannabis use, correct? Can you tell us about this one and what makes it different?
AB 2188 amends the FEHA to add employee protections against discriminatory practices the employer might do based on their knowledge of the person's off-the-job use of cannabis. And what that means is, basically, if you find out that somebody smokes, which is legal in California, you cannot use that knowledge to make adverse employment decisions. What it means for employers is that it creates a significant change to how and when we can use drug testing on employees for cannabis and what they can do with those results. So, for example, if you get the drug screen back and it says that they test positive, you may not be able to use that information in the way that you have used it in the past. In fact, you probably cannot. It does not permit employees to be in possession of or impairment of or use cannabis when they're on the job. So that's still going to be a no. The reality check on this, you know, and I tell a lot of my clients this, you still have the right to maintain the drug-free workplace. That is still your right as an employer. You can still hire or fire based on scientifically valid pre-employment drug screening conducted through methods that do not screen for non-psychoactive cannabis metabolites. Whew, that's a mouthful. What it means is, when we've known this for a bit, marijuana stays in your system for a very long time. So if there is non-psychoactive cannabis in your system, then they're probably not high. And you cannot make an employment decision on that. What does that mean for us? We don't know. It's just become very complicated. I do tell my clients this also. Listen, if somebody came into work drunk, would you let them work? And they say no. I said, great. And if somebody comes in high, you don't let them work. We're making it far more complicated from our side of things, I think. We don't allow people under any influence of any kind of drugs. This is just another one. It is legal, just like alcohol is legal. So we just have to be careful about the screenings now and what those results show.
Well, let's talk about non-compete agreements. Senate Bill 699, I believe. What does this do?
Senate Bill 699 for the non-competes, this is, you know, the bane of existence in California, arbitrations and non-competes. Again, effective January 1st, it's just reinforcing California's law on prohibiting non-compete agreements, which most of us know have been in effect for a long time. And the key here is that it's going to prohibit employers from entering into or enforcing non-compete agreements that are already in place. So this means any agreement you have in place. I was recently at a legal update, and even the attorneys were shaking their heads on that one. They were quite entertained by this. You can certainly ask people to sign an arbitration agreement. What you can't do is enforce it. So the question begs, do you need one then? They're not enforceable. And if you force employees to sign them, then SB 699 provides them, the employee, with the right to seek injunctive relief and civil penalties. So one more area they can file a claim in.
Right. Just what we need, right?
Yeah.
More and more.
Yeah, because we're not busy enough fighting other things.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, workplace violence is obviously a key issue with human resources. What does Senate Bill 533 require employers to do? And this one has a later effective date, correct?
Correct. So this one doesn't take effect until July 1 of 2024, partly because we have to get our ducks in a row. They passed the law, but we don't have really clear guidance on what this means, although there's more and more coming out. So what it means is that we are now going to be required as employers to establish an actual workplace violence prevention program. Similar to our IIPPs, we have to include very specific information in this. There's going to be record keeping requirements, of course. The plans have to include very specific information and procedures. So some of that includes things, you know, the obvious stuff, the name and job title of the person who's going to be responsible for it, the effective procedures to obtain active involvement of employees and authorized employee representatives, so union representatives, here's the kicker, in developing and implementing the plan. So they have to be involved in it. There has to be a coordination of the plan with the employees, including staffing agencies, so that they know what their role is going to be in this. And you have to provide them, you know, probably with your plan, a copy of your plan, so they know what they're going to be complying with. You also have to include the effective procedures for the employer to accept and respond to any reports of workplace violence and prohibiting retaliation for anybody who might make such a report. The procedures have to get really detailed on things like where did it happen, you know, and who they're supposed to report to. Any kind of procedure for like emergencies and evacuations and sheltering, that all has to be in there. There also has to be a post-incident response and investigation. So there's a lot entailed in that. And then eventually, you know, your plan has to be reviewed every year and revised as the laws require, as you need to. And some of those revisions may happen if you have repeated incidents in a certain area or with certain groups or departments. So it could change depending on your work environment too.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's talk about Senate Bill 497, Rebuttable Presumption of Retaliation. That sounds pretty legal. Tell us about this one. Tell us about this one and what it means to employers.
Isn't that a fun one? This one's actually pretty simple, and I'm guessing most HR professionals know what this means, and we just shake our heads and we move on. It's effective January 1, as you said. This is literally just creating a rebuttal presumption of retaliation. So basically saying if there's a claim that the employee makes saying that they were subjected to an adverse employment action within 90 days of when they engaged in a protected activity that's defined by our labor codes, it is presumed that that is true, that they were retaliated against. And therefore, the burden of proof shifts over to the employer, and the employer must now prove that retaliation was not in play when they made that decision. So the adverse action, whether it was, you know, they were written up or they were fired or whatever the adverse employment decision was, they have to show that that was not the reason for that action because the employee filed a claim.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Well, I understand that Assembly Bill 594 gives public prosecutors the ability to prosecute violations of the labor code. Can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, this was an interesting one. I will tell you, same legal update we were having. There was a room full of like 300 HR people, and we all groaned when we heard this one.
Yeah.
This was just strange. So again, going into effect January 1, our current law shows the labor commissioner who is the primary person responsible for enforcing our labor code. However, AB 594 is going to give this ability to public prosecutors, and they will be able to prosecute violations of the labor code either civilly or criminally until January 1st of 2029. That means city and district attorneys will now have the authority to sue employers for certain workplace violations, for example, willful misclassification. So they would be able to do that. It also provides that any employment agreement that requires arbitration of a dispute or limits representation, you know, union actions, would not affect the prosecutor's ability to enforce this labor code. So they have a lot of freedom here. The question mark in the room was, is this going to lead to more PAGA claims? Probably. Right. What doesn't?
Right. And my comment was going to be, this sounds like a revenue generator for attorneys is what it sounds like to me. You know, let's get our case. Well, let's get our billable hours up.
Yeah. The interesting part about that one is the law was interesting in that it stated the whatever monies come from it, the employee gets paid first, which is kind of interesting.
Okay.
We'll see if that really works out that way.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean no offense to attorneys, because I have a lot of friends that are attorneys. So I need, no offense to you. But anyway, it's just a general comment. I didn't mean to offend anyone. So fast food minimum wage will change again with Assembly Bill 1228. Can you tell us about this and when it goes into effect?
Sure. So everyone knows, I mean, we all know that all of our minimum wages are going up in January, but these were interesting because the fast food minimum wage was in response to last year's Fast Food Accountability and Standards Recovery Act, which was AB 594. And remember, that one was basically enacted to set industry-wide standards on minimum wage and working hours, working conditions, and so on. So it was going to go to ballot this year. And what happened was negotiations between the fast food businesses and labor unions came into play because they decided this probably would not be a good ballot thing. They're going to spend a lot of money fighting this. So they came together and they negotiated this new rate. It is going to increase to $20 per hour for fast food workers, and it will affect all national food chains that operate in California.
That's a lot of money for a fast food worker.
You know, all I can say is I'm glad I don't eat a lot of fast food because I couldn't afford it now.
I know.
I don't need a $40 McDonald's burger.
Exactly. That's the first thing I thought of, is the cost of all the fast food is going to go up and up. It's not going to be a cheap run, you know, take your kids to the fast food restaurant for lunch real quick after school or before a sports event or something like that, because it's going to cost a lot more money. You're right.
Those Happy Meals are break you.
They will for sure. So what about the healthcare industry minimum wage, Senate Bill 525? So what does this mean? How much will it be? And when does it go into effect?
Okay, this one's going to go in effect June 1st of 2024. The minimum wage is interesting. Generally, it's $25 per hour. However, the definition of healthcare facilities is all over the place, and they're varying. So there's hospitals and clinics and nursing homes. So anyone in the healthcare industry really needs to look at what the standard is going to be for their specific facility as defined by the Department of Healthcare Access and Information. So that is the second part of this. The Department of Healthcare Access and Information, is going to publish an online list of affected healthcare facilities by January 31st of 2024. All I can say is for those people who are in the healthcare industry, they know to keep an eye on this. They've been seeing this bill kind of bantered about for the last few months. So now that we know it's been signed, I would just recommend that they really keep an eye on that and what the definition is for their own workplace. There's also an effect on salary people, clearly not defined yet, but all of those things, they need to keep their, you know, finger on that website,
right,
to keep track of what's going to be happening and what's actually going to be implemented and what they're going to have to comply with for their specific locations.
Yeah. And there are two sides to this. And in my mind, one, I think healthcare workers need to be paid fairly and so forth, mm-hmm. because they're doing a lot and, you know, and it's very risky for them at times with all these communicable diseases and everything else. But on the other hand, the cost of healthcare just keeps going up and up and up. And this certainly won't help that at all. So I'm concerned about that as always. But anyway, so I have mixed feelings on this one. Let's talk about SB 723, the rehire retention of displaced workers in the hospitality and service industries. I know we talked about this one last year. Can you tell us more about this one?
So you're correct. This one amends SB 93 from last year that basically required employers who had laid people off due to COVID that they rehire them, specifically hospitality and service industry employers. This new law, SB 723, is going to redefine what the definition of laid off employee means. And what it's going to mean now is any employee who was employed by the employer for 6 months or more and whose most recent separation from that employment occurred on or after March 4th of 2020 due to COVID, then they are going to be eligible to be rehired.
Okay. What about the people that just didn't want to go back to work for so long because some, you know, they were collecting all those benefits and so forth and they just chose not to. And now they can be rehired, sure. But I don't know if it's going to help bring people back to work or not, because people, I think, got used to hanging out with mom at home and hanging out with relatives and, you know, and not wanting to go to work. So I don't know. I have mixed feelings on this one as well, but you know, no personal.
Well, you know, and part of that is going to be, as we know, you know, documenting what's happening. So when you make that offer and you tell somebody, hey, you know, you can come back, we're supposed to be documenting that stuff and saying, all right, what does that mean? If they refused, I mean, HR's mantra is document, document, document. Right. Get it in writing that you made that offer for them to return and that they did not, that they chose not to, whether it's because they want to sit home and eat bonbons and watch soap operas with mom, I don't know. Or if they just like collecting unemployment. But we need to be documenting this to make sure that people aren't getting, you know, that option of just sitting at home or taking unemployment. If the employer is going to be obligated to this, then they need to document that they made that offer and that they complied. And, you know, the result was the result.
Right. Exactly. Well, what about Senate Bill 848, reproductive loss leave? What's this all about?
Yeah, this one was an interesting one. I'm on the fence about this one. I understand the pain of it. Yeah. It's, you know, does everything have to be legislated?
So. Yeah. Yeah,
there is that. So again, it will take effect January 1. And what it says is this: we have to provide time off for our employees who are eligible for leave up to 5 days. And this includes things for failed adoptions, failed surrogacy, miscarriage, stillbirth, or an unsuccessful assisted reproduction. The law limits the amount of leave to 20 days within a 12-month period. Interestingly enough, last Thursday, there was an attorney presenting on this and corrected this to say it is a maximum of 5 days. But that's not what the actual law says. So unless something has changed, the law states 20. So we will get more, I'm sure, direction and guidance on this when everything starts to come into play. But for now, I would just tell everyone, plan on those 20.
Wow.
Because, yeah.
That's a lot of time off. That's a lot of time off. And that's expensive for employers. And it's hard to fill some of those positions for that long, you know, that amount of time. And I can see why you have mixed feelings on that. Yeah. I do as well. I mean,
and it's unpaid leave, but, you know, clearly people can use their PTO, or they can use their sick leave while they're on this. One of the things that we are waiting to hear clear guidance on, and this question has come up more than once in the last 3 weeks with some attorneys that we've all been on calls with. Does this mean that they get 5 days of this plus 5 days of sick? The reason the question came up is because one attorney said one thing, one attorney said another, and everyone's very confused now.
Right.
Because you all know in California, we have leaves like CFRA and FMLA, if you're 50 or more employees, and PDL, and all of these other leaves have to interact with each other. So now we have one more that we need to decide. And then someone threw a really big loop in there and said, what about bereavement? How does that play with this? And we're like, oh my goodness. So this is going to be complicated.
It sounds like it's going to take a while for this one to kind of get, you know, settled, and they'll probably have to wait for additional regulations and so forth to come out before people are really clear on it. I would guess that they're just working off of law text right now, which, as we know, and a lot of people know, is very general, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, from my experience, and you know, Dorothy, I've been in this game for a bit.
Yeah.
I would say you can do what's more generous. Because California always says if it's better for the employee, that's what you do.
Right.
So for now, until we get clear guidance, and if you have in-house counsel, then they can guide you too. But yeah, it's like any of our laws. They put laws in place and then they think later about how they're supposed to actually play out.
Right. Right. Well, it sounds to me so far that there's a lot of things that are going to have more economic pressures on employers in 2024 than in the past, but that's pretty much an every year occurrence here in California.
Well, this law, just as a side, this is only going to apply to anybody who has five or more employees, and they have to have worked for the employer for at least 30 days. There is also no provision that allows you as the employer to request documentation in connection with the reproductive loss. So again, wow, same things that apply. We cannot ask, well, you know, it's private medical information. They can get a doctor's note, but you can't ask for specific documentation. You can just say doctor's note. And you can't retaliate. I mean, which we know that's a non-starter anyway.
Right. Well, I could see some potential there for employee abuse on this one. I hate to say that, but I see some potential there for that, for sure.
Yeah, hopefully not, but could be.
Let's hope not. Let's hope that it works out like it was, you know, how it was supposed to work, you know, be a helpful thing and for everyone concerned. Well, let's talk about some federal laws. Can you tell us about the PUMP Act?
Sure. So the PUMP Act, again, like you said, this is federal law. It was signed by President Biden back on December 29th in 2022. So it's not a new one. Just a reminder that we in California have, you know, in certain areas like Los Angeles, there is, you know, breastfeeding and higher standards for certain things. But generally speaking, California does require that we provide a place for employees who are expressing milk to have a private area to do so. The PUMP Act just literally puts that as a federal law across, you know, all the states. So it will apply to almost all employees that fall under the FLSA standards, so Federal Labor Standards Act. Here's the kicker. We're waiting to find out if it's going to apply to remote workers, which the response in the room was, what? Because if you're at home, of course you have a private area. We would hope you do. But,
right.
You know, as anything else, these laws are crazy. If you are doing this at work, it's going to be the same compliance as California, that they have to have a private area. It has to have running water. It cannot be a bathroom. It has to be shielded from view from coworkers. So, you know, and it can't be a public open place. So one of the things that you need to know about this one is it only applies to employers with 50 or more employees. So similar to the FMLA. Mm-hmm. An undue hardship is going to be a real tough one to prove on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm not looking forward to this because I know I always hear about this stuff from our clients that complain when they hear about these things. They say, just more and more work for us and more costs for us and more this and more that. So anyway, but I guess since it's federal, though, it does take some of the burden off of blaming the state of California, I guess. You can blame
the state. Yeah, I mean, the rule of thumb when we have stuff like this that really mirrors California law is really look at the two laws side by side. Whichever provides more to the employee, that's the one you're going to follow. So whatever the higher standard is, that's where we go.
That was going to be my next question. So thank you for that. Yeah. So let's also talk about another federal law, the Federal Pregnant Worker Fairness Act, the PWFA. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, this one again, it went into effect in the summer. This was strange because it was signed again back in December of 2022, and it went into effect on June 27th of this year. So it surprised a lot of people who didn't know about it because it was a mid-year law and it was just so strange. And then, you know, all of a sudden everyone got all these notices. Did you implement this? In California, because we have PDL, probably not going to affect most of your guests because they're complying with California's, which is a higher standard. If you are not complying with PDL for some reason, then you will need to comply with this. And what it simply says is you have to provide reasonable accommodation for qualified employees who have any kind of limitations due to pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions, you know, if you have 15 or more employees, it's going to, you know, be something you must comply with. In California, it's the day you hire the pregnant person, even though they didn't tell you they were pregnant. They're going to be covered under our PDL. So in that instance, you would comply with PDL because it's a higher standard.
So generally speaking, then the California law has a higher standard. So they pretty much need to comply with that, which would automatically put them in compliance with the federal law. It's just at a higher level, correct?
Yeah. Generally speaking, it's going to be California that we're complying with because it's already in place and it already does all the things. One of the things that I thought was really interesting in the PWFA is this. They specifically called out that if you have a pregnant employee, one of the things that they have to comply with is appropriately sized uniforms. So you can't give the pregnant server a guy's extra large shirt when that's not what they should, you know, so they can't be looking sloppy just because they're pregnant, kind of thing. So I thought that was interesting that they specifically called that out.
Okay. So are there any other ongoing training requirements for employers that they need to know about or be reminded of?
So one of the things that's really kind of a hot ticket item is the California Consumer Privacy Act. This went on steroids. It's not a law per se. It's amended to our original CCPA. This is going to be dealing with civil codes, not labor codes. So the recommendation is everybody needs to take a look at their current policies and update to meet the new standards. You can only ask questions, and in your policy, you can only state that you will only ask questions within the scope of your policy and the business purpose. So we are not allowed to delve into private information that has nothing to do with the scope of our policy or the position they're going to be in, the job, the business. So you can't ask people about their financial situation if it has nothing, if their job is going to have nothing to do with that. Obviously, there will be exemptions, you know, for things like law enforcement that does really thorough backgrounds. The language has to be sufficiently broad but narrowly tailored to be defensible. So when you write your policies, you have to be really specific in what it is that you're going to be using this for. Don't tie your hands, but also don't get too broad that you can't defend your position of asking certain questions. There is now a 5-member board to enforce this, and they have the authority to make rules and fine you $2,500 per violation and $7,500 for intentional violations.
Yes, that definitely is, that'll get people's attention, especially when they're probably
money talks.
Yeah, money. Exactly. Money talks. Well, as you know, I do a lot of privacy and security training, so we talk about this as part of that. So hopefully, at least our clients, I know our clients are already complying with these things, but as things change, it's good to have reminders about this. Are there any other new or ongoing training requirements for employers that we should talk about?
So a couple things. You need to make sure that you get your training done for your workplace violence. There is going to be specific criteria. You're going to have to keep those records for your training, just like we do the IIPPs and things like that. So make sure you do that. Obviously, sexual harassment prevention training, you please make sure you're on top of that. They are starting to really look at employers who don't have that and intentionally don't do their training. So whether you do it online or you do it in person or you send your people somewhere, just get it done. It has to happen within 6 months of an employee being hired or 6 months of an employee being promoted from employee status to supervisor status. So even if they just did their employee training, you promote them to a supervisor, then they must complete the supervisor training within 6 months of that promotion. So please make sure you get that done. You know, it's an ongoing thing. So it's every 2 years. If you're not sure, you should be pulling your records to look when you are due.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And just as a reminder for everyone, again, because of my privacy and security background, I'll just remind people that you do have to also have training for various levels in your organization for HIPAA privacy and security, and now the add-on to that because of the Department of Labor cybersecurity guidance that came out in 2021 that a lot of people aren't aware of, but we've been pushing pretty strongly here the last year or so, the cybersecurity portion of that. So that needs to be looked at and reviewed, and you need to train your people on an ongoing basis because of cybersecurity risks and things like that. So since we're talking about training requirements, I thought I'd throw that in as well. That's really important. Thank you, Kathy, for all of this wonderful, valuable information. Although we may not like all of it, we may not agree with all of it, it's still important for everyone to know that they need to do these things. So thank you very, very much. If anyone should like to reach out to you, how can they do that?
Yes, they can reach me at Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, at trainmetoday.com, or visit our website at www.trainmetoday.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And for everyone out there, please have a great holiday season. We're going to take a break until mid-January, as we always do mid-season, so that we can all enjoy the holidays. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable coming in January. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel, as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754, extension 3. Toll free at 866-658-3835 or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.